This is the BBC. Here is a special announcement which has just come in. At 10:45 this morning, a flying saucer was reported to be in trouble over the Atlantic. I will repeat that. At 10:45 this morning, a flying saucer was reported to be in trouble over the Atlantic. That is the end of the announcement. We shall interrupt programs as soon as any further information is available.
Yes, well, people certainly did wait by their radios. The flying saucer had apparently stopped flying and started floundering. What happened after it landed, or more properly when it ditched, is best known to the archives of the United Nations, and also, if I may say so, to myself. My name is Lester Frabjoy, United Nations Information Center, London. And I'm here to tell you the unexpurgated story, as I know it, of the Charter in the Saucer.
The British Broadcasting Corporation, in association with the United Nations Radio Division, presents the internationally famous star of film and stage, Laurence Olivier, as Lester Frabjoy in The Charter in the Saucer, a fantasy mixed with fact, written by Norman Corwin.
Yes, well, the first close-up of the historic saucer was announced by a lookout aboard a weather ship named Cumulus whilst patrolling in the Atlantic west of Ireland. Cumulus is a converted corvette, a sort of floating weather station, one of 10 ships that the UN maintains on the high seas, more or less to keep air passengers from getting their feet wet. And while Cumulus' main task is to see that pilots are advised on weather, she also keeps an eye open for anything unusual. One can't blame the lookout for getting excited.
Kijk, bij de brug. Er zit iets aan de wacht op vier strijker en stuurboord. Lijkt op een van de vliegende schotels.
I neglected to say that the Cumulus is a Netherlands ship manned by a Dutch crew. And just as the lookout said, there, off the starboard bow, a disc-like object, gyrating dizzily and obviously out of control, hit the water with a violent splash, skimmed across the surface like a flat stone thrown sideways, and came to rest practically at the accommodation ladder of the weather ship. Immediately, a boat was lowered. I refer you to the log of the Cumulus.
11:07, picked up the sole occupant, uncommunicative, M towing the saucer. 11:08, made signal to Admiralty.
Yes, well, since England was the nearest UN member, advices were naturally sent to the British Admiralty. The signal was received in the operations room in Whitehall.
Here, I say. Here's a report from a UN weathership that a flying saucer is disabled alongside.
A flying saucer? Oh, they must be in their cups.
The intelligence was at first viewed dimly by the First Sea Lord.
Rubbish. Who's responsible for this?
And the Cumulus was contacted.
Admiralty to Cumulus. Saucer message received. Are you sober?
To which the weathership replied that it was.
Well, so they mean it. Captain, have Plymouth send out something to bring in this thing. What destroyers have we got down there?
Irresistible, irrepressible, irreducible, and irremediable, sir.
Send irrepressible at once, sir.
Her Majesty's destroyer, Irrepressible, steamed to the position under full speed. But while she was still en route, rumors circulated through the news channels. No one knows just how the story leaked out, but it did. And in becoming public knowledge, it suffered a sea change. The newsboys in a capital city on another shore shouted alarming headlines.
Saucers attack!
Earth invaded! Martians attack!
Saucers attack! Warfare!
These headlines took up the entire front page of most of the newspapers, and their readers were duly alarmed.
Martians on the march! Jiminy Cricket!
Hey, did you read this? Saucer seizes United Nations weather ship off Irish coast. British Navy in action. Well, what do you know?
The Admiralty, the War Office, and the Foreign Office were immediately besieged by the press, radio, and foreign ministries of half the world, asking for confirmation or denial of the report. And in the midst of the confusion, the Home Secretary telephoned to the First Lord of the Admiralty.
They tell me the Irrepressibles carrying captured Martians to Plymouth.
In the first place, my dear sir, nobody's established that they're Martians.
Furthermore, there's only one of them.
Oh, I see only one. Too bad. But in any case, instantly he arrives, he will, of course, enter the purview of the Home Office.
Within an hour, the BBC broadcast a news bulletin from London.
In the first test match against Australia at Trent Bridge, England won the toss and at the close of play had made 158 for 8 wickets. That's the end of the news, but we're repeating the announcement heard earlier by listeners to the Home Service. There is no immediate cause for alarm in the matter of a flying saucer having landed. There is no apparent danger. The Prime Minister is in constant touch with HMS Irrepressible, now en route to Plymouth, and he reports no necessity for abnormal measures. Should there be any deterioration in the situation, air raid warnings will be sounded.
When the broadcast was picked up abroad, it was interpreted variously. One news commentator analyzed it.
Now it's official. Even the usually conservative BBC admits the situation has deteriorated. Air raid warnings have sounded. As I talk to you, London may be in flames or vaporized. The end of our way of life may be near. This may be my last broadcast. If so, I want to say goodbye and thank all my friends and listeners, and especially my sponsors, the manufacturers of Glamourprease, the toothpaste of stars, which is on sale this week at your neighborhood store. But to get back to news, there can be small doubt with whom the Martians are in league on this earth. Unfortunately, it's too late to do anything about our ambivalent foreign policy. For a long time, I warned that...
By the time the Irrepressible steamed rather noisily into Plymouth, towing the saucer, they were on hand to meet her, and Under-Secretary of the Home Office, representatives of Scotland Yard, Professor George Popham, Chair of Philology, Oxford, who speaks 27 languages, an anthropologist, a nuclear physicist, press and radio correspondents, a recording engineer, and photographers. As you can appreciate, the excitement grew at the dockside as the moment approached when, for the first time, they would glimpse the first visitor from outer space. Standing by, alert to capture the moment, was that stalwart of the BBC on great occasions, John Snagg.
And here he is. He's coming down the gangplank between two of the ship's officers. He's small. He can't be more than about 4.5 feet high, and I should think he doesn't weigh more than about 5 stone. He's not unlike us. He's got a head and two arms and two legs. His eyes are rather far apart. They look a bit reddish from this distance, and a nose, I don't want to be rude to him, but it can perhaps best be compared to the spout of a tea kettle, and a very small mouth. He appears to be very shy indeed, though he's not without dignity, and his whole bearing is...
None of the correspondents was, of course, permitted to interview the creature. He was speedily whisked out of public view and taken to a conference room where scientists and government officials tried to communicate with him.
First of all, gentlemen, I propose we offer the chap a cup of tea. Who think that's an idea?
Tea was brought to him. He was wary in approaching the cup, but after an exploratory taste, he drank with satisfaction. And it was apparent to all present that the chap obviously represented a civilization of some culture. The distinction of being the first human being to question this most foreign of foreigners fell to Professor Popham, the philologist, who started by asking him who he was. At first in English, then in the Romance languages, and then in Chinese.
Guixing.
In Hindi.
Aap kaun hain?
Arabic.
Intermin, min fadlak.
Russian.
Kto vy, pozhalosta?
Tagalog.
Sino pobakayo?
And even as a last resort, in Chatsa, a patois of a lost language, central Cambodia.
Ang tak ba ching.
Throughout all this, the saucer man was silent and motionless. He sat regarding his relatively large feet in an attitude of timorous indifference. For 2 hours, attempts were made to get through to him, and then something happened which electrified the room. Suddenly, the visitor raised his head, smiled faintly, and said...
I wish to speak to a man from you.
You wish to speak to whom?
Man from Yun. Only to a man from Yun.
The experts looked at each other in total amazement, then hastily confirmed.
I assure you, there's no such place. Perhaps he thinks he's on some other planet.
That can't be. He's speaking English.
Well, let's ask him what he means.
I say, sir, just where is that? Woman.
Yun. United Nations.
Ah, he means UN. Isn't that what you mean? UN?
Yes, UN.
The astonishment of these eminent men at the visitor's awareness of the United Nations was increased when he refused to answer any further questions and indicated that he would feel secure only in conversation with a qualified representative of the UN. The Undersecretary of the Home Office, Mr. Westerby, immediately telephoned Whitehall to find out who was the ranking UN representative in Britain at the moment.
What's his name? Fred Joy? United Nations Information Center? Well, get hold of him and fly him down here. Yes, I know it's midnight. I don't care if he lives at the bottom of a coal mine. Get him down here.
Actually, as a matter of fact, I live in Kensington. I was contacted in due course and packed immediately. When I got to Plymouth, I was briefed. The immediate concern was lest the saucer people had intentions of attacking, and I was urged to find out as much as I could. The saucer itself was still being investigated by a swarm of scientists, and the general apprehension was that the immigrant from space, representing a civilization vastly superior to ourselves, might, if able to transmit some sort of signal, bring on a general attack. And that his people could do what they wished with this mediocre satellite of an average star, which we call the Earth. The grave and historic import of my role was impressed upon me, especially by the Undersecretary.
Every second counts, Fred Joy.
Yes, sir.
This is a solemn hour. We're threatened by a power greater than we are, a race of supermen.
Yes.
The very existence of life on this globe may hinge on what you're able to divulge in the next few minutes.
I understand, sir.
Are there any questions?
No, sir.
Please come this way.
Was led into a room and left alone with him. His red eyes glared at me, and he slowly rose. For a moment we faced each other in silence, and then I greeted him and told him my name. He replied.
Credentials, please?
I showed him my credentials. He studied them carefully and seemed satisfied. I then asked his name.
Fuzz.
And the name of the planet from which he had come. He did not hesitate to reply.
Galala?
I don't know why it had never occurred to me before that the inhabitants of Mars, for this was indeed his planet, would have their own name for it. It was Galala. I asked him why he'd left home.
Troubles?
What kind of troubles were these?
Depressions, wars, sickness, poverty, hunger, insecurity, fear, too many taxes, flooded canals, and the winters are too long.
Seemed to hesitate, watching me for some sign of sympathy. I nodded and said, please go on.
There's also great stupidity.
Stupidity, Mr. Vaughn?
I believe that's the word you use to indicate ignorance and sloth.
Oh, but surely a civilization capable of building a flying saucer...
We call them quiffs.
Surely a civilization capable of building quiffs, something we haven't been able to do. Surely a people capable of speaking a language of another planet without ever having set foot there.
Ah, Mr. Frabjoy, the gift of speech is our one great talent. We have more than 2,300 languages in Galala. We learned English by listening to your radio broadcast aboard our griffs as we hovered over your cities.
Oh, so you have radios.
Don't give us credit for that. They were on the griffs when we found them.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
We didn't build the griffs. Technically, we are not very bright. The griffs were made by creatures on Glubria.
He later explained that Glubria was the Martian name for the planet we call Jupiter.
And when they landed on Galala, the Glubrians perished because of the relative thinness of our atmosphere. We found full flying instructions aboard the griffs, and so we were able to manage them after only 3 centuries of trying.
But why did you elude us for so long? There were a great many reports of flying saucers, and our fastest jet planes were never able to catch up with you.
2 reasons. First, we are shy because we are so inferior to your civilization. Second, we can't land on your small landing field.
Yes?
Fred Joy, just a moment, please.
What is it?
Have you made any progress?
I believe so.
But, Fred Joy, you didn't come up here to have a social visit with this fellow. The Prime Minister's on the telephone. He's meeting with the Cabinet. The Commonwealth governments have been informed. Everybody's waiting anxiously. We're holding a circuit open to the Secretary General of the UN in New York. Now, what can you tell us?
I can tell you to relax and urge you not to interfere just now, sir. The Galalan is being extremely cooperative.
The Galalan?
Yes. From what he's just disclosed, I can assure you, you will find the Gwyff is not an instrument of aggression.
Gwyff?
Yes. It's Glubian in origin, not Galalan.
Glubian?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I must ask you to leave. We're being inconsiderate of Mr. Valance.
Mr. Valance?
That's his name. And now, if you will excuse me, please. I'm sorry. Now, to resume. For what purpose, may I ask, did you hover, as you put it, over our cities?
We were listening to your broadcasts with the hope of learning something from you that could improve life in Galala.
I see. And did you find anything?
I think so. A sort of Tweety.
Tweety? Oh, Treaty. Ah, just what treaty are you referring to?
I believe you call it the Charter of the United Nations.
Oh.
Especially what you call the preamble.
Oh, yes, the preamble, of course.
I would like to know more about it. Some things I cannot understand. Very baffling, in fact. Do you have a copy of it?
Well, no, I'm afraid not. Well, not with me.
I have it written in my language aboard the Gwyff. Let's go aboard and get it.
In my enthusiasm, I started out with Vaz, forgetting that a room full of authorities was waiting impatiently without. A Scotland Yard gentleman stopped me as soon as I opened the door.
Well, can we help you, Mr. Frabjoy?
Yes. Where is the vehicle on which this gentleman arrived?
Stand back. Don't crowd. I'll handle this. May I ask why you want to know, Mr. Frabjoy?
Yes, we must get something aboard it, you see.
Well, what is it you want to get?
Well, there's a charter in the saucer.
A charter? Well, I'm sorry, but we can't permit you to board.
In that case, I demand the right to speak to the Secretary General of the UN.
Well, I suppose that is your right.
I spoke by radio telephone to the Secretary General in New York and explained the circumstances. He said the UN had already formed an emergency commission for liaison with interplanetary bodies, ECLIB, reporting directly to the Security Council, and he appointed me, pro tem secretary of the commission. Armed with this authority, I insisted on boarding the saucer, and this was agreed to, with the proviso that the guns of the Irrepressible be trained on the Gwyff, trained on the Gwyff, in case Fuzz attempted to take off with me as captive. Together, we climbed into the saucer, which had been hoisted onto a platform. The hatch dropped over my head, and I was now alone with a spaceman on his own spaceship. I shall not go into the details of the interior of the saucer, since you've all seen the diagrams in the picture weeklies. But once inside, Vaz opened a panel and removed a piece of what looked like parchment covered with symbols.
I shall read it as I copied it down during the radio broadcast.
Very good.
Preamble to the Charter of the United Nations. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to ensure all-day loveliness, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought this bargain offer of untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, why be half safe in the dignity and worth of that oh-so-good, mellow human person in the equal rights of men and women, to give you that added pep, and of nations large and small, offering the economy size for this week only, and to establish conditions under which
Just a minute, Mr. Vaz. Over what hemisphere did you hear the broadcast from which you made these notes?
The Western Hemisphere.
And on what instrument, may I ask?
This radio.
I think I understand what happened. Would you kindly operate the radio now?
It's about me, too. A small Japanese dog.
Give it to the children. Give it to the whole family. Serve Zip, that truly wonderful breakfast cereal, every morning.
Attending for the first time the new course at the Atomic Reactor School at Harvard in London.
Yes, just as I thought. Your tubes are defective. You apparently heard more than one station at the same time, and as a result, certain extraneous phrases accidentally got enmeshed in your version of the charter. You see, the term all-day loveliness has no connection whatever with the document and is of no earthly interest to the United Nations.
Just what is all-day loveliness, Mr. Frabjoy?
I explained this as best I could. Then, whilst the authorities waited irascibly, I weeded the commercial slogans from the text of the preamble. Once this had been done, Mr. Fuzz became even more impressed by the spirit of the charter, and after reciting the preamble aloud several times to make certain he understood its meaning, he said,
"It seems to me full of very noble sediments. But have you been able to combine your efforts to accomplish these aims?"
Yes, some. And to a greater extent than is generally realized.
In what ways, may I ask?
You may indeed. But this question cannot be dealt with at one sitting, you know, since the answer's worldwide in scope.
Would it be possible for me to see the charter at work?
That can be arranged. In the meantime, we must give assurances that you represent no danger to our security.
Galala, a danger to the earth.
Well.
West assured, Mr. Fabjoy, the apprehension is au contraire.
I gather you hovered for some time over France, Mr. Vaux.
En effet, monsieur, en effet.
Thus, arm in arm, and in good spirits, we emerged from the saucer. Though the nations were not getting along well at the moment, the planets were. And I was privileged to be, in a sense, the medium of this strange entente. As soon as the first shock wave of publicity hit and passed, Mr. Vaz and I withdrew from the public eye and sat down to work out an agenda. We divided the preamble, the core of which runs to only 177 words, into 9 parts, in order that Vaz could study each in succession and learn whether in the few short years of the Charter's existence the ideals it expressed had been honored by practice.
It would be most instructive to us on Galala to know whether such lofty sentiments are just so much fluff.
That's a Galalan term for palaver or double talk.
Or whether they really have some practical application.
I told him that we Earthlings, too, were interested in the answer to this question. And then, whilst he was brooding over the remark, I relayed an invitation from the UN's General Assembly to address that body in New York. Buzz begged off on the grounds that he was a poor public speaker. Then, without a pause, he made an odd request.
Mr. Fabjoy, could we go fishing before we leave for UN headquarters?
Fishing? Gladly, yes.
There are no such creatures as fish on Galala.
Oh.
And I am intrigued by the idea.
Well, I know a stream which in the past has yielded good results in brook trout.
What an interesting name. Brook trout.
We set out next day for the country. They went biting. And after an hour or two, Buzz tired of it and sat back against a tree trunk. His line dangling in the water. Thunderstorm was piling up in the east, but as it was not headed our way, we stayed where we were and talked.
Let me test my memory. 1, we the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind.
Letter perfect.
Twice in your lifetime. Big wars.
Oh, yes. If I remember the figures correctly, in the First and Second World Wars, about 110 millions were killed or wounded, tens of millions made homeless. The cost to all nations came to almost 2,000 billions of dollars. That would be roughly the equivalent of $2 million for every man, woman, and child in Great Britain today.
My. We've wars on Galala all the time, but they are very much inferior. Some of our wars have cost as little as 12 dwamchis.
Dramchi, explained later, is worth roughly £1 sterling.
So you see, we have a great deal to learn.
I wondered if perhaps he was speaking sardonically, but it soon became clear that he had no conception of the staggering nature of earthly wars. I had a bit of trouble communicating this to him, and I was busy describing some of the wars, big and small, which had preceded World War I, when the lightning storm, which had not impressed him up to now, suddenly intruded. He reacted with such intense fright that I had to reassure him we were in no danger and that the bolt had struck a mile away.
That was terrifying.
Ah, but not as terrifying as war. You have no idea how loud and vivid a war can be. A single minor battle has been vastly more destructive than all the thunderstorms from the beginning of time put together.
Tell me more, Mr. Fabjoy.
I soon convinced him of the distastefulness, the inconvenience, and the horror of war. Then I acquainted him with the fact that since the first recorded history of mankind, there have been some 6,000 wars fought, and that the United Nations Charter represented only the second organized attempt in history, and recent history at that, to put a stop to aggression.
And have you had any success?
Well, yes, we have. I picked up a branch and drew on the sandy bank of the stream a rough map of the world.
You don't have to draw a map, Mr. Fabjoy.
I've studied your planet from great altitude.
Oh, yes, of course. This is just to make it clearer. Now, you see, Mr. Buzz, you see this large area. It's called India.
Oh, yes. I hovered over India many times.
Yeah? Well, the United Nations and the UN alone prevented a war between India and Pakistan, which might have killed millions of people.
Really? Yeah.
And over here, in a small area named Palestine, a war broke out, which might, in an earlier day, have spread into world proportions. The United Nations and the UN alone stopped that war.
Really?
Yes.
Stopped it in full flight?
Yes, arranged a truce.
Remarkable. Nobody ever truces on Galala. We fight till one or the other is dead. Sometimes both.
And see here. Far across the globe, these islands called Indonesia.
Oh, yes. Java. I spent some time hovering over Bali.
The United Nations and the UN alone stopped a war between the Netherlands way up here and the people of these islands.
Then you have saved succeeding generations from the scourge of war.
Some, not all, and not enough. Not yet, at least. But millions of human beings are alive today who might have been destroyed but for the mediation of the UN. We have a long, long way to go, but we have made a start.
You have given me a great deal to think about, Mr. Fabjoy. A great deal to chew.
Whee! You have a bite there, Mr. Buzz.
Oh, so I have. So I have.
The special plane that took us to New York was the fastest on the transatlantic service. Yet Mr. Buzz remarked to the stewardess,
"How slow we are traveling. Is there some reason for this?"
"Perhaps it only seems slow, Mr. Views, because you're accustomed to the speed of a flying saucer."
"Perhaps."
The stewardess retreated, and Mr. Buzz turned to me.
"I feel drowsy. Do you mind if I sleep?"
"Why, not at all. If all Galalans sleep like Buzz, I'm sure that sedatives are unknown on our sister planet." In fact, even when he awoke, Buzz remained in a foggy state and barely came to his full senses in time for the first event on our calendar in New York. It was a concert at Carnegie Hall. We sat in a specially enclosed box out of respect to the visitor's morbid fear of the public gaze. He listened for a long time, fascinated, to the music. At length he turned to me.
"Why are we here, Mr. Fabjoy? What does this concert have to do with the preamble to the Charter of the United Nations?"
"Well, let me explain. You recall the second of the 10 sections of the preamble?"
"We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person."
"Exactly. Now, this concert is in honor of something called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights."
"What a long name."
"Yeah. The declaration was adopted by the General Assembly back in 1948, which isn't long ago. Every year since then, on the anniversary of the day it was signed, a concert such as this one is presented somewhere in the world."
"All this fuss and music just for human rights?"
"Ah, it's little enough, Mr. Buzz. The declaration is the broadest promise of freedom in the history of the world, and I earnestly commend it to your study. As for the music..."
"On Galala, the music is so bad, we sometimes fight for the white not to listen to it. There was a war once over that question."
"Well, I'm afraid human rights are far more serious. Many wars have been fought to obtain them."
"What are they like, these whites?"
I started to explain, but at that moment there entered our box a young lady from the Human Rights Division for the UN. She was extremely attractive, and for the first time since I'd known Buzz, his curiosity about a person overcame his shyness.
What did you say your name was?"
"Laura Atkins."
"Oh.
My dear Buzz, you handle that electric shaver as though you've been using it all your life."
"Does that look better?"
"It looks absolutely fine.
I'll go over my face just once more."
Buzz's vanity had been stimulated by his attraction to Miss Atkins, and it was only with difficulty that I dissuaded him from having his nose remodeled. This quickening of romance happily coincided with the third section of the preamble to the UN Charter, which was next in line for his study.
"Three. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to reaffirm faith in the equal rights of men and women..."
"Buzz, my friend, stop right there. We're taking a little trip."
"Where to?"
"Venezuela."
"Venezuela?"
"This is the BBC. Here is a special announcement which has just come in. At 10:45 this morning, a flying saucer was reported to be in trouble over the Atlantic. I will repeat that. At 10:45 this morning, a flying saucer was reported to be in trouble over the Atlantic. That is the end of the announcement. We shall interrupt programs as soon as any further information is available. This is the BBC. Here is a special announcement which has just come in. At 10:45 this morning, a flying saucer was reported to be in trouble over the Atlantic. I will repeat that. At 10:45 this morning, a flying saucer was reported to be in trouble over the Atlantic. That is the end of the announcement. We shall interrupt programs as soon as any further information is available.
Yes, well, people certainly did wait by their radios. The flying saucer had apparently stopped flying and started floundering. What happened after it landed, or more properly when it ditched, is best known to the archives of the United Nations, and also, if I may say so, to myself. My name is Lester Frabjoy, United Nations Information Center, London. And I'm here to tell you the unexpurgated story, as I know it, of the Charter in the Saucer.